not with the type of separation that we could get here. I'm not familiar with any operations like that. I think that a proposal that they have had in Los Angeles is when the winds are calm or when there's less than a, I forget offhand, a 10-knot wind, that aircraft will take off downwind. So that what they've got is an aircraft landing from over the water and taking off over the water during certain hours at late night. But this is an opportunity that they have in Los Angeles. Two reasons. One, they have a very continuous prevailing wind there, and also the characteristic of the area is for the winds to drop very considerably at night. And also these runways are substantially further apart. Now, they have parallel runways that are only 700 to 800 feet apart, but they've got the two sets of them. So they can operate that way on those close parallels, but they can operate on
wide
one on each side of the terminal area, but there has to be very...
They have to have
they aren't. I don't think those are going to be done simultaneously.
They'd have to have instrument, and they'd have to counter-rotate the traffic. I'm not sure whether at the present time the impact of noise is greater in a taking off or a landing airplane, because the landing airplane is usually lower and the taking off airplane's higher, so that the ambient noise on the ground is about even. But at any rate, all of these other runways route taking off aircraft over populated places, whereas the seaward runway routes the taking off aircraft to seaward. Considering that those people vote too, I think that Chelsea would be in a fool's paradise to assume that aircraft will not continue to land, make their landing approaches over Chelsea, and in substantial numbers, particularly when the wind is from the east. I do think that looking ahead 20, 25 years for our schools here, that it really is up to the Port Authority and the City of Chelsea to get together and solve the school problem. And I think that's... I just wanted to ask another question. Has hovercraft been considered at all as a method of access to the airport from the City of Boston?
I can't say specifically on hovercraft. I know that the hydrofoil has, and just plain other types of boats. Now, actually, because of the distance,
of course, is that it can operate on your airport, deliver the passengers to the airplane, and deliver them also to a dock in town. But I'd never seen it mentioned, and I just wondered if it ever had been. There seems to be some particular problems with respect to patents on hovercraft and so forth. And
I think probably that one of the biggest problem that we saw was not on the airport side, but rather the on the city side. The question as to whether or not someone would go to a waterfront area in the downtown area, of course, is the parking problem and the how do you get to that point. And
they could come from Weymouth Air Station also. I think that my point was that just how dead is this parallel runway?
Well,
I mean, it's all there.
I don't
see
know
that it's laid right out on the map.
How dead you can make it. The fact is that it was on the plan for years and years and years. It was on from 59 when the Port Authority took over, and it was on when the state had it. It was on a piece of paper. It hasn't been built yet, and I'll have to admit that we were serious about it when we made the proposal, and it hasn't gone anyplace, and I don't think anyone's fighting in that direction. Now, we obviously can't say that things couldn't change and people would change their minds 10 years from now, but just the staff wanting it or even the Port Authority wanting it does not make it necessarily possible. And so the facts are that there was a lot of opposition to it, and it's as dead can be at this time.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions or comments?
I would like to ask just one question from my own enlightenment. I wonder why the planes fly so low. I live on Hawkins, and it seems to me that I have a loud voice. And it seems to me that the planes are practically on my roof. And, of course, they fly 24 hours a day. I'll stay up till 12:01 hoping that the planes will stop so that I can go to bed. But it doesn't do one bit of good. They're flying at 3 and 4 and 6. And really, I think that we should have some peace of mind. There should be some kind of a limit. And they should, and why are they flying so low? I expect them to hit my roof or my tree any day. And they're continually, I have timed them, I would say, a minute between each plane that goes by my house. And it's really very unbearable, and it's detrimental to my health. I'm a nervous wreck, because I do try to stay up as late as I can, hoping that they will stop flying. Now, something should be done by the Mass Authority. There should be a limit to the flying. After all, I think if we had an industrial plant here in the city and they were a nuisance after 12 o'clock, they would immediately be stopped. Now, why can't we do something about the airlines? After all, we are a community here. I've been here myself over 50 years. And I don't want to move. I like this place. I know everyone. And I'm happy here. Now, I think that this should be taken into consideration, as Father has said, the human part of it. We have no objection to the airport. I use the airlines. I'm very happy with them. But we have to have some peace of mind here.
Thank you very much. Would you give your name just to keep
My name's Anna Cohen. I live at 7 Cottage Street.
Thank you very much.
Quite prominent here in the city. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I wouldn't want anyone to think that the Port Authority is not concerned with human beings. let me just cite a couple of things, if I may. Number one, and we're not trying to make excuses, we're the airport operator. We're the ones that we are the one that has to come and try to reconcile the operation of the FAA and the airlines, excuse me, and everyone else, along with our own responsibilities. But we're assuming that burden, and we're trying to do the best we can. Now, we are not pretending that aircraft noise is not a darn disagreeable thing. What we are doing is trying to reduce it as much as we possibly can, and at the same time cooperate with the FAA and the airlines to make the airport as safe as possible. And the safety of aircraft is the safety of people that are being overflown, so that the problem is a difficult one. It is not solved as yet. Most of us believe that it is being solved, but I don't think enough effort was put into it 10 years ago to have it in a tolerable situation today. But those who know the types of aircraft that are coming into operation, the 747, the DC-10, the Lockheed 1011, will grant that these aircraft are quieter than the old aircraft, the 727s and DC-9s and the 707s and DC-8s, so that there is that hope and general evidence that the aircraft noise problem is being resolved. Now, at the same time, I trust that you won't mind if we speak of other people's responsibilities, such as the consideration of a second major airport. We are not the ones to determine that there should be a second major airport. That is a responsibility of higher authorities. It is also the responsibility of higher authorities, the federal government, to have research on quieting these jet engines, retrofitting the older aircraft with soundproof coverings, and to generally try to set standards of certification for new aircraft that are going to make it quieter. Now, the Port Authority and the entire airport community sit around every month trying to do something in terms of either the control of ground noise, taxiing APUs, auxiliary power units, and ground power units, and that sort of thing, and in-flight operations. But, as I've said before, when you have diesel locomotives going over people's houses, there's nothing that the Port Authority can do to make that a very pleasant thing. But we're here to let you know what we are trying to do. And I would ask your indulgence to take a look at a film which Dr. Daugherty has brought along, which shows one of the tremendous responsibilities of the airport. The airport has to try to keep all of these aircraft operating in safe circumstances. And one of the matters which we would want to make safer is the mixture of small aircraft and large aircraft. And the reason particularly, or one of the major reasons for this Stoll General Aviation Runway that you've heard spoken of tonight down in Bird Island Flats, 3,800 feet, this runway down here, is to allow small aircraft, not just the very small, but small and, let's say, medium-sized aircraft, and have the commercial aircraft on that particular runway. Dr. Daugherty has a film which shows the hazards or the turbulence that these large aircraft build up. And perhaps you'd care to take a look at it for a few minutes.
Well, as I mentioned, I'm here representing Executive Airlines. I'm the Director of Safety for Executive Airlines. And I think that what I say now can apply just as well to other commuter airlines. Can we turn that film on, please? The reason why we want that parallel runway, the small one that you saw, not the one you've heard about, talked about in the past, but the short takeoff and landing runway, is so that our planes will not have to land and take off on the same runway as the large jets, which are using 1533 and which you've heard flying over Chelsea tonight. You'll see here the wake of a DC-3. Now, this is a relatively small airplane. And when this DC-3 goes by, the wind's from the right to the left as you look at it here. After he goes by, his vortices will be blown downwind to come across this smoke, and you'll see the small tornadoes created by large-sized airplanes as they take off and land. Now, there's a fairly powerful air current there, and the larger the plane that creates the jet vortice, the longer it lasts. In the case of a 707 or 747, they last many minutes, and later you'll see what happens when planes try to fly through the jet vortices of such aircraft. Here's another picture of jet vortices created by a relatively small transport airplane, the DC-3. Now, I don't want you to think I'm bringing up something that's just a maybe sort of a problem. It's a real problem in everyday aviation. Every day in aviation, or every year, many, many lives are lost when small aircraft attempt to use the same runway as large planes, because they fly through these vortices, which without smoke are invisible. You won't see them until they come over and strike the smoke. Now, the Executive Airlines and the other commuter airlines in this region primarily use a plane called the Twin Otter. And so that you'll know that it's a real problem for the Twin Otter, about 18 months ago, a Twin Otter crashed at JFK, killing the crew and passengers. As a result of flying through one of these vortices. One of the things that I wish is that the one of the speakers, the priest from Chelsea, had been here because I could have assured him that the planes he heard taking off and landing and climbing up so quickly weren't, and making so much noise, weren't the stall airplanes that he thought would be using this runway. A stall airplane is one that takes off in a very short distance, not one that climbs very, very fast. In fact, our planes aren't great climbers. They don't climb nearly as fast as the jet airplanes, which outclimb us at a rate of 5 to 10 to 1. Here you see a much larger plane going by, and you see a much more extensive smoke system from several points on a tower to show how much larger the vortices are created by this large aircraft. You won't see them until they get into the smoke. They'll come from left to right here. And very suddenly, you'll see the clouds start to whip around, and if you were a plane landing that was caught in that vortice, you could be thrown down the runway with quite a bit of force. Now, we, of course, have a very selfish interest in wanting to have that runway, but we think it's an overriding one. Whenever instrument conditions prevail at Logan Airport, we're forced to use the same runway as the large aircraft at a considerable hazard, we think. This is just to show that all kinds of aircraft create them. However, when small planes like a helicopter create them, they don't last nearly so long. They're very violent at first, but don't last long once the helicopter's gone by. You see how it's already started to dissipate. Whereas with the large aircraft, it persisted for quite a while. This one's good in a way because it shows how the vortices have to go downwind, have to flow with the air before they get to the smoke and create the disruption. That helicopter actually flew by some distance off to the left. And where you have your greatest hazard is in still air. If you've got a crosswind like this, it blows them away from the runway. But when you have still air, as you do in instrument conditions, the vortices lie right there in the runway at the very path that you're going to have to fly through. And during instrument weather, you typically have much stiller air than you do on clear days. They're going to show that here again in a minute and show how turbulent air will cause the vortices to disrupt. First, they'll have a C-47, that's a DC-3 airliner, fly by and leave a train of smoke and calm air, and you'll see how it lasts. And that's the kind of air. You don't get calm air very often on clear days. But you'll see how long the trail of smoke persists on a day with still air. And it's the day with still air that we have to land on the same runway with the large aircraft. You can see what a smooth trail of smoke is leaving behind, and those vortices that are leaving behind are staying right there surrounding that cloud of smoke and not drifting away. And you'll see what a big help it is to a pilot to have rough air as you have on most clear days, because the sun heats the ground and causes air to rise and dissipate the vortices. That's in the next flyby. Here's the flyby in the gustier, and you'll see that these vortices are being dissipated very quickly. And this is the case on the clear day, but on the clear day, we don't have to land on the same runway as the large aircraft. They're being dissipated much more quickly and blown away by the turbulent air from the ground. You can see some of that when you look at the across the ground and see the shimmering of the heat waves. Now, the interesting part of this film is coming up after this flyby, because you'll get to see what happens to airplanes that attempt to fly in the core of these kind of wind currents. I've got to apologize a little bit for the quality of some of the film to come, because some of it was taken with videotape. Now, this is a fairly large aircraft, and this is the most startling example of wake turbulence here, involving a large size aircraft. The rest are somewhat smaller. Here you see a 747 flyby, and then a fairly large passenger jet's going to try to fly by after it. And you'll see the hazard that I'm speaking of, because it is much more resistant to those vortices that you see created in the smoke. It's much more resistant than the planes we fly. Camera's going to zoom back so you can watch the 737 try to fly through there. And it's been a fair while now since that 747 went through, and you no longer can see the vortices in the smoke. The next sequence of films is to show how large size helps protect the aircraft from wake vortices. In the first case, we're going to have a Convair 990, which is a four-engine jet, follow the large aircraft. They're using a C-5A, which is a military transport. It's a very large plane and leaves substantial vortices in its wake. And you'll see this is really quite a large airplane. Now, it's quite a ways out there, and in its wake is an attempt of a Convair 990 to fly through the vortices that this aircraft has left, and they're fairly well marked by the plume that the engines have left behind. It's flying from 3.5 to 4.5 miles behind the C-5A. It bounces around a fair amount, but it never really gets upset. Now, if you were a passenger on that plane, you might get pretty queasy. But in terms of controlling the plane, the pilot's able to do it. And that's why runway 15 and 33 is safe for the large planes to use, because they can get along with each other fairly well. Even though there are substantial wake vortices, and even though the pilot has to get pretty busy sometimes during a landing because of these air currents, for a large plane, it's not that big a hazard. You can see that this plane can keep control of itself pretty well. Now, when we go to the DC-9, which comes next, you'll see it's not so simple. Now, this DC-9 is following the C-5A at a distance of over 5 miles. And 170 knots, that's... 3 miles a minute. It's a couple of minutes, almost roughly a couple of minutes back behind the C-5A. This is where the quality is not so good, because it's taken to the videotape. But you can certainly see what's happening to the DC-9 here in a minute. because he's going to have substantial trouble keeping control of his airplane. And remember, the DC-9 is a lot larger than the planes that the commuter airlines use, the Twin Otter, much larger. It couldn't take off and land on the stall runway we're talking about. It's going to be relegated to or continue to use 1533. Now here he gets in one that gives him a lot of trouble. If he'd been landing then, he'd have a serious problem, which is why he can't safely follow the large planes in at a time limit of only two minutes. The next sequence of films, which will be the last one, is going to show a plane our size and weight, which is the Learjet, following the C-5A at a distance of 3.7 miles. The quality really gets poor here, bear with me, but you can see the attitude of the airplane, although you can't see the details. You're looking from the rear of the Learjet, so you can't see the pitch. You can't see the nose up and the nose down, but you can see the wings level problem, and you'll see that he's rocking around a fair amount, and bit by bit, the rocking gets worse, and then he loses it. There he goes, all the way over. And I've had a friend that's had that happen to him in a plane on final approach to landing, because he was too close to the jet vortices of the aircraft ahead. Now, to let you understand what that's like to a pilot, the next sequence of films is going to let you see what it's like if you're in the cockpit of the Learjet when it undergoes that particular series of events. And here the quality of the picture improves a lot. Standard Kodachrome. Now here's what that looked like from the pilot's point of view. And here he goes over, which is no fun. That's the end of the film. I appreciate very much your letting me show that. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have on it. And I think you can see why the commuter airlines feel strongly that they need a separate runway from the large aircraft. Any questions?
My name is Minsk, and I'm honest, Minsk. I think one of your later pictures answered it. What I wanted to know was about how far away would the second plane be? It should be before it would be subjected to the. Currents, the vortex, and also the timing. Well, it seems to me that if these situations take place, then why shouldn't they then require that planes take off or come in at a very, very decisive long time, after.
Okay. I think the question was, why don't you see to it that the time separation of the aircraft is large enough to prevent this? And the answer is, there is such a regulation, but it requires that human beings think each time it happens. That the controller thinks, or that the pilot of the following plane thinks, or in terms of takeoffs, if you are flying on relatively close parallel runways as we are now, that the pilot think not to fly through the wake vortex. And it's hard to remember to do that in the days of airplanes that don't leave a trail of smoke behind. That was a military plane, not a civil plane. The civil planes more and more are leaving no trail behind them at all, and it's very hard for pilots to remember to avoid something that's invisible. The way to engineer it out to make it impossible is to not use the same runway. If you rely on human beings to think to do this every time, before long, as happened down at Kennedy, somebody forgets. It's easy to forget something that's invisible like this is. Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Dr. Daugherty. Are there any further questions or comments? If not, we want to thank all of the people who are remaining out of the 25 or so people from Chelsea who are here tonight. And we trust that you've gained something. We trust that you realize that we are attempting to present to you the ideas that will be the initial contribution to the master plan. And as I said before, if anyone wants to present any additional ideas in writing over the course of the next 2 weeks, we'd be happy to receive them. Thank you all.